So let's open the scrapbook now and look back to 10 years ago today when the Supreme Court put the beleaguered and rickety electoral system of the United States out of its misery, in a sense, in the Supreme Court decision that gave George W. Bush the presidency in that disputed 2000 election. Listen to these voices now. Katherine Harris, lawyer David Boyce, Bill Daley from the Gore campaign. You'll recognize some voices here. Just listen.
Governor George Bush, 2,900,000.
Until those votes are counted, this election cannot be over.
I'm requiring a written statement of the facts and circumstances that would cause these counties to believe that a change should be made.
There's a desire to try to shut this down too quickly, and I think that's unfortunate.
I doubt if the Florida Supreme Court meant to have these counts go forward only to have them be ignored.
Neither he nor I anticipated this long and difficult road. Certainly neither of us wanted it to happen. Yet it came, and now it has ended. Resolved as it must be resolved through the honored institutions of our democracy.
I will work to build a single nation of justice and opportunity.
Gore v. Bush, 10 years later. How are those honored institutions of our democracy doing? It certainly changed politics for the past decade. But what of the legal system? Joining us to analyze the significance of Bush v. Gore and its impact on the Supreme Court even today is Jeffrey Toobin, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the book The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi, John.
I gather your book needs a sequel at this point, wouldn't you say?
Well, I'm working on one. although I don't think they're going to be deciding any more presidential elections. I think the odds are against that.
What do you think the sort of impact on the court was, first of all, to be presented with this case? It's both a states' rights case and the sort of viability of an electoral process case, and among many other issues. And the decision itself, what impact did it have on the justices, on their feelings about what transpired over the subsequent 10 years?
Well, I think in the immediate aftermath, there was more bitterness on the court about this decision than any other within a generation. But the Supreme Court is a resilient institution, both internally in terms of the relations among the justices and in terms of its public perception. And I think the court remains a very respected institution. But I think it was a reminder that remains valid that the court is deeply political in the sense that the ideology of the justices matters a great deal in how the cases come out.
You know, since then, this court has shown itself to be very pro-states' rights on a whole variety of issues. But in the Bush v. Gore case, there's a certain ambiguity here. Can you explain what seems to be a contradiction to me?
Well, I think what a lot of people, including me, find troubling about Bush v. Gore is that the conservative majority, the side that won, usually stands for certain principles like states' rights, like staying away from judicial activism, like a narrow conception of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And what was so troubling about Bush v. Gore is it seemed to betray those principles to reach a result that they wanted to reach, which was George Bush winning the election.
Well, I mean, and in your article about this, you talk about the number of times that important cases are cited later as part of legal doctrine, and you said that they've never cited Bush v. Gore again, which kind of implies that this was a completely unique situation, that the justice's decision related only to this case and nothing else.
Right. One of the most troubling and most quoted lines from Bush v. Gore is a line apparently written by Justice Kennedy, although there's no signed opinion, that said essentially, this ticket good for this train only. In other words, this case only applies to this fax. And, you know, what appeals courts are supposed to do is lay down general principles. And the fact that they seem to view it as just a one-off for the benefit of this particular plaintiff, George Bush, you know, is troublesome if you want to view the court as a principled institution.
You know, the interesting thing here is there's also an echo of Watergate, it seems to me. I recall, of course, President Ford decided to pardon Richard Nixon to end a kind of national nightmare that intuitively at the time seemed like, yes, let's get this behind us. He suffered bitterly for that. I'm wondering if the sense of dealing with a state of emergency, which the court was doing, trumped a sense of the long view legally here.
That's an interesting comparison, frankly, which I'd never thought of. But I think the analogy works in some way because, you know, there is always a sense, particularly in Washington, where people always think things are perhaps more important and more urgent than the rest of the country thinks it is, that you have to resolve something and principles be damned. Well, you know, sometimes you can take a little longer than you think and let the process play out, let every side have a voice, count all the votes in the old familiar phrase, and that in the long run is better than simply cutting off a momentary crisis.
You know, the court has demonstrated down through history a doctrine of, in general, not intervening in findings of fact by juries unless there are broad issues of discrimination. You know, we can talk about that, you know, in another segment. I'm wondering if this changes the doctrine of not intervening in state and local elections, that the voter's voice is inviolate and courts are loath to overrule that. Are they more likely to overrule since Bush v. Gore, even notwithstanding the notion of one ticket, one train?
Well, I think it's even a broader point than that. I mean, what conservative jurisprudence has meant for decades was let the democratic process go forward. Don't intervene in states, in localities, unless you really have to. And you know, that's been the fight over abortion. It's been liberals who want to overturn state laws, conservatives who say, no, let the democratic process go forward. What we've seen in the Supreme Court over the last 10 years is a much greater willingness on the part of conservatives to be activists, to say, you know, this campaign finance law, we think it's unconstitutional in the Citizens United case.
Right.
We think local gun control laws are unconstitutional in the Heller case, in the McDonald case. That the conservatives are much more aggressive than they used to be in striking laws down.
Wow.
And that's a change.
Well, you can hear his mind working there. He's working on a sequel to his book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, talking about 10 years after Bush v. Gore. Jeffrey Toobin, staff writer for The New Yorker. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks, John.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.